session number 18455, Reel 2.
Ron Hodges, Reel 2.
Well, I'll say it was Saturday morning, was the battalion parade on the square at Wavell Barracks, and everybody turned out plus the band, and we were drilled for something like an hour with the RSM. And the RSM at that time was Batter Edwards. He was called Batter like because he was a boxer, and I think he'd have broken those cauliflower ears, this sort of thing. But he was a real disciplinarian, as they call it. And he would drill us for something like an hour. And at the end of that hour, then the officers would come out, the officers' mess, and all the junior officers anyway. And they would join a battalion, a bit more drill. Then eventually the CO and senior officers would come out, and they'd parade in with the battalion, and the CO would take over. And then it was... it could be everything. Troop in the colour, like the guards troop the colour now on St James's Palace, that we troop the colour, this sort of thing. And Germans used to come down there, all stand around the railings at the barracks watching, and I think to see the light infantry drilling, going at their fast speed and trailing arms, it must have been something worth seeing, I should rather imagine. The band at that time, they used to double out under the square plane, which... some people don't believe, but at that time they did. The band actually doubled onto the square plane, but Colonel Jeffries stopped that because I think a lot of buglers and them sort of players were getting their mouths and teeth knocked about, and he actually stopped the doubling out of the band. But of course we still marched to the 140 paces to the minute, which I sometimes was speeded up to, I think, about 160. I know I can't do it nowadays, I've tried. Impossible. But, and that used to be the morning. Several men would be finished up in the guard room. I remember one time, but it was very, very cold. And one man actually fainted on this parade, which wasn't allowed. It was against rules to faint. But he fainted, and as he fell back, he fell into the two ranks at the back of him. He was taken off on a stretcher. And he'd be, can't remember what he was charged with, but the other two men were charged for moving on parade and disobeying the lawful order, because the last one they had was to be at attention. So I think they got 7 days or 14 days in the guard room, on jankers anyway, for moving on parade. And that's how it was. But Batter Edwards could always see the man moving in the back rank of the back company. Oh no, he wasn't very tall, so when I used to think about it, it's impossible, he couldn't have seen that man move, but that was a fear that he instilled into everybody, that he could see everybody on that parade. And but they were really smart with the Durhams, really a smart turnout.
But wasn't treatment like that about punishing the fainting man and the men who were hit by him resented as unfair?
Oh yeah, of course it was. But then again, Batter Edwards was... a fair chap, because he often used to give them the option of going in front of the company commander or going in the boxing ring with him. And so in the afternoon, those that volunteered to go in the boxing ring with him, on a Saturday afternoon, it was down to the gymnasium to watch Batter Edwards batter them. And that's exactly what he used to do. Some were going in with the idea of running around the ring and the RSM never catching them, but he always won.
Did anybody lay him out?
Never, I never saw it. Anyone might have done, but I never saw it. We used to go in for a laugh. It was hilarious.
What happened next?
Well, after that, we had a passing out. We had, not a passing out, like a goodbye, parade in Berlin, where people turned out to see us. And then it was back to England, back to Brandsforth Castle Barracks, which is just outside Durham. And from there, we almost immediately went up to Bellaby Moors over the top of Catterick to do some more training. And for 2 weeks plus, I can't exactly remember how long it was, but we never saw the inside of a tent or a building. When we got there, there were tents laid out for us, and we put our main kit in these tents and then marched out And they went up and down the moors for a fortnight or more, exercises, attacking, being attacked, laying mines, taking them up. A boots turned white and the socks just disintegrated. But although we thought that was rough, it seemed to rain every day. We thought it was rough, but it was nothing to what we were going to get in Korea, but we didn't know at that time, of course. So after that, it was back to Bransworth. And what they done there, we got in lorries on this Bellaby Moors, went down through Catterick and onto the A1. And then all the battalion had to get out of these lorries, all except the band, and we started marching back to Bransworth. And I think we were marching an hour, stopping 10 minutes, marching an hour, stopping 10 minutes, something like that. And we seemed to go around everywhere. We went around little villages, towns, and every town and village we got to, the band got out of the lorry and marched the battalion through the town or village at the regimental pace. And eventually we got back to Bransworth. Some men feet were in a bit of a rough condition, but they it was done. I think they're all toughening up for career, I suppose. I think Colonel Jeffrey was making sure he could, whatever was in front of us, like you were going to manage it. So, I think it was that time we got leave, and I believe we had a couple of weeks leave. And then reported back to Bransworth, where we'd done a bit more drill. And then we had a parade right through the centre, a going away parade, through the centre of Durham City, up to the cathedral. And all the battalion lined up on the green in front of the cathedral, grounded arms. And we all went into the cathedral for a service. And they also dedicated a book of remembrance to the men of the regiment that died in the 39-45 war. And then it was out, and another parade back through Durham, back to Bransworth camp. I thought that night or the night after, we were also given a night out at the Sunland Rink Ballroom. And anybody that lived adjacent to Bransworth could have gone home on a visit for that night. But those of us who couldn't were at the go to Sunderland. And from that night onwards, we were confined to barracks and eventually moved out. I think it would be about 25th of July. We moved out and went down to Southampton.
This is 52.
Pardon?
1952.
Yeah, 1952, yeah. Yeah. And eventually arrived at Southampton. And boarded the Empire Trooper. And I thought, I didn't know nothing about ships. And I thought, looking at the Empire Trooper, I thought, wow, that's a big ship. But after we'd been allocated our places on the ship, went on the top deck, promenade deck, whatever they call it, and looked across the pier, and I was looking across at the Queen Mary. And I suddenly realised that the Queen Mary was a big ship, and that thing we was on was more like a rowing boat. So we left Southampton, I believe, on the 27th of July 1952. I believe we left, and off we went. And it was absolutely terrible. We were on troop decks. I can't remember how many troop decks. There were probably five, something like that. No portholes. The only air that got down there was through little forced air vents like there are on aircraft, and that's the only air we got down there. It was absolutely stifling. All we had was a sea kit bag with a sort of personal kit in, and we were decked out by that time in olive greens or jungle green, whatever you want to call it. And we found it nigh on impossible to sleep down there, and we used to go and sleep on deck every night apart when it was rough seas. The officers, of course, they were in cabins, and I think some of them enjoyed a cruise out to Korea, but everybody else found it absolutely terrible. The beds, well, they weren't beds, there was sort of two poles fastened to the ceiling and the floor, and suspended off them were six frames, and they were our beds. and the routine on the ship, well, I think nowadays everybody would desert. You started off in the morning, there'd be reveille, and then it was up, breakfast, well, washed and shaved first, breakfast, stow your gear, what bit of gear you had, and then it was off to lifeboat stations. While we were at lifeboat stations, men on fatigues cleaned all the troop deck up. Any kit that had been left, like a spare pair of socks, a shirt or whatever, was thrown overboard. And at a certain time, the master of the ship went round to inspect all the troop decks. And if they were good enough, we were stood down from lifeboat stations, and then we started training. That could be running around the boat, firing at targets off the back of the boat, having lectures on mine, buoy traps and goodness only knows what. And that went on till lunchtime, when you got about an hour, hour's rest. And then it started again in the afternoon, lectures, and we never had a minute. And that went on until evening meal. Can't remember exactly what time that was. And we have evening meal and that was it for the day. And by that time all you wanted to do was lay on deck, you couldn't lay on your bed, couldn't go down there, it was terrible. And then it came again to master's inspection at night. And master's inspection was coming down onto the troop decks. What he was inspecting, I don't know. But we had to be in bed at a particular time, and the master of the ship, the CO and whoever, would come down dressed in their night uniforms, what I can't think what they call the dressing up uniform now. And we'd have to lay to attention in bed while they inspected it. You can't imagine it. Well, in the light infantry, there isn't such a thing as attention. It's light infantry parade. So as they approached the troop deck, it was given light infantry parade, and there we were, laid to attention in bed while the master walked. It was absolutely ridiculous. And as soon as they'd gone off the troop deck, we grabbed a blanket then up back on top of on top deck to sleep the night away. And that was a routine. It was a rough passage.
Did you have much idea about what to expect in Korea?
Oh yeah, we were getting easier lectures on what to expect, but I think those at the lectures didn't know either, because a lot of the information we were given was completely wrong. What we did get, when we stopped at different ports going out, like Aden, Singapore, Hong Kong, various places. I remember stopping at Aden, and everywhere we stopped there, we had to have a route march. I think everybody else would go ashore and enjoy themselves like that, but no, we had to have a route march. And
what do you mean by everybody else?
Well, all the units on that ship, there was all the Durham Light Infantry, something like 1,000 men, I suppose, going up that way. But there are other bits of units going out to various places, Hong Kong, Singapore, some to Korea, might have been Royal Artillery, Royal Signals, all sorts of bits of units on their own, and they'd be let off the ship and go and enjoy themselves. But the Durham's had to go for a route march. And I remember Aden, we got off at Aden and went for a route march and went straight up into these mountains, and it was like an oven. And we were carrying rifles and packs, all this sort of thing. And we got way up into these mountains, it was difficult to breathe. Never mind march, and the battalion was stopped for a rest, and men could have a drink out of the water bottles. Only thing was, we had no water in the bottles, because on the ship water was only allowed at certain times, and unfortunately when we got off the ship it wasn't the time, so the men had no water in the bottles. The officers had, because I expect they could get water at any time. So somebody discovered a mistake had been made, and it was a matter of turning around and getting back to the ship before men started to collapse. But that was a way of things. So after 6 weeks and 2 or 3 days, give or take a day, we arrived at Busan in Korea.
What were your first impressions of Korea?
Well, I remember looking over the side of that ship and wondering what the devil we'd come to. It looked absolutely awful. It smelt. But thing that cheered us up on the dockside at the side of the ship, there was a welcoming party of goodness knows who, I don't know. And there was also this band, American military band there, all black soldiers they were. And Colonel Jeffries and most of the officers were up on the top deck there looking over the side, and I think they expected the national anthem to be played or something like that. But these here black soldiers struck up with something jazzy like Are You From Dixie or something like that. Well, the men were, you know, falling about laughing, and I think it was a bit humiliating or disappointing for the officers up on top. But it it cheered the place up a bit. And then eventually off the ship and onto a train, which was to take us north of Seoul. Seoul was the capital of Korea. That was about 30 miles south of the 38th parallel. And we were to go up to Tokchon, railhead at Tokchon. That journey, I believe, took 2 days and a night. Well, I could be wrong on that, but I believe it was 2 days and a night. The carriages, no windows in. The seats were just wooden benches. The toilets at the end of the carriages, like ours on the railway, but all it was a hole in the floor, no wash basin, nothing of that nature. And there we were, piled into these carriages, kit, rifles, Bren guns, ammunition, goodness only knows what, you couldn't move. And the engine just chugged away. It had stopped for an hour, hours on end at times, pushed into sidings, pulled out, and there's no... I think we got off once, off that train once, to get a cup of tea or something. Every time it stopped, the officers got up and walked up and down to stretch the legs, but we were sat there, legs hanging out the windows and all sorts. In fact, it was that hot, and I remember a lot of us taking the boots off and had our feet hanging out the window. It was absolutely murder. But we eventually arrived at Tokchon, got off the train, then we were taken by lorry. I think it was New Zealand, or anyway, I can't remember whose lorry they were, but we were taken to what they are called, Camp Casey. And this Camp Casey was like a transit acclimatisation camp. It was, it wasn't something you want to go to on holiday, I can tell you. And that was the first time I'd ever seen toilets in a marquee. And what they were, there was a long trench, goodness knows how deep it was, and on top of this trench there were beer boxes upside down with a hole cut in, and there'd be something like 20 boxes side by side, back to back, and that was the toilets. There were nothing personal, nothing there. And anyway, the battalion was going to be a week or two acclimatising, but I was unlucky again. I was always unlucky. I got picked out to go up the line. I think there were 10 of us at Salt Pioneers got picked out to go up the line and go in with the Australians to learn the minefields, learn where they were before the battalion moved up. And so we were given a lecture again, what to expect. We'd be taken to lorry, by lorry as near as they could on the road. Well, the road, it was only a track anyway. And from there we'd be met by an Australian soldier guide, and he'd take us up onto the hill, onto the position that we were going to be on. And this is what happened. We were instructed that once we got off that lorry, there would be no lights, no talking, no noise, absolute silence, nothing. So we arrived at the end of the road, and sure enough, there's an Australian waiting to guide us up to the position. It was pouring with rain, and he took us, well, we didn't know where we was going, slipping, sliding, one thing and another. Eventually went up this hill onto this Salt Pioneer Hill, Australian Salt Pioneers, that they were on, and you wouldn't believe it, when we got up there, they were sat around a bonfire drinking beer, and it was a complete opposite to what we'd been told. And
in what sense?
Well, there's supposed to have been silence and no noise, no lights, And there were all these Aussies sat around a bonfire drinking beer. You know, it was absolutely astounding. And at the same time, of course, you could hear explosion and one thing and another going off. And I was shown into a dugout, well, we called them hutches. And it was only about 4 foot high or something like that. And I said to this Australian, I said, well, don't you think it'd be better if we dug this out so we could walk around? And he said, don't worry, he said, by the end of the week, you'll be able to walk around. I didn't know at the time, but we were stood on boxes of beer, and they were about three high. And as the week went on, the floor lowered, as they drunk the beer, of course, and at the end of the week, sure enough, you couldn't touch a roof. But them Australians are a great fella to be with. Their rations were better than ours. I couldn't believe it. The first morning I went for breakfast, and he said, how many eggs do you want? I couldn't believe it. And their rations were great. They had about 1,000% more money than us. We were, at that time, we were on less than £2 a week, and these fellas were on £14 a week plus, depending what, you know, what qualifications they got. In fact, I think a private got as much as one of our captains. I think it ran something like that. They also got a free issue of razor blades, soap, boot polish, this sort of thing, where we had to pay for all ours. But they were great fellows to be with. And the night before we got there, this particular platoon had been ambushed coming back into their own position. And I think there were two had been killed. And one of them had jumped into the minefield and feigned dead. And the Chinese had emptied his pockets and taken his watch. And but he got his way back, you know, he got back. And that same fella went out the following night with us on, well, he took us out, well, even some more. He took us out on our first patrol, which was airy. Well, when I say airy, that's really frightening. When you leave your trench for the first time and go over the top into no man's land. Yeah, it's frightening. There's no John Waynes. All John Waynes have gone. They disappear. And but it's something you have to get used to. But these Australians are full of confidence. They knew what was going on, and it was great to be with them fellas.
What was the most frightening thing about the patrol?
Going into the unknown, because you had just no idea, just no clue whatsoever what you were going to. Well, that first patrol, we were going onto a minefield. I think we were repairing a wire on the minefield. But you had absolutely no idea, really, what to expect. You know, you could imagine all sorts of Chinese lined up waiting to shoot you and one thing and another. Could imagine all sorts, if you let your imagination run away with you. But you felt a bit more confident being with these Australians, because they'd been there for the best part of a year, and they were used to it, so it was a matter of sort of watching what they'd done.
What happened next?
Well, eventually the battalion moved up. I can't remember, I think about 10 days before they moved up, not quite sure. And our lads came up and the Australians went off. And so we started our own platoon routine. And this hill we were on our own. And it was slightly behind the rest of the battalion. And we started a routine there. It was, he started at night, it was stand to at night before it got dark. He'd stand to in a trench, everybody. Would stand to in a trench on facing the Chinese. You'd stand there for about an hour until it got dark, and then you get the order, stand down. And so we'd stand down, and there'd be two points on the hill that was manned. Two Bren gun pits were manned all night. Be two men in each pit, and it just depended how many assault pioneers were on that hill to what sleep you got, because Some of the assault pioneers had gone up to rifle companies to do various jobs, go out on patrols or whatever, and whoever was left had to man the hill. So you might get 2 hours on stag. Stag, as you call it, was standing there for 2 hours. 2 hours there, you might get 2 hours off to sleep and back on for 2 hours. Or you might get 2 hours on, 4 hours off. It just depended how many were on the hill. But all the time we were there in the line, we never ever got a full night's sleep. And then, of course, wherever you were, you're in the trench again before daylight to stand to again in the morning until it got light. And then you get the instruction to stand down. Well, in the rifle companies, when everything was done at night, patrols and all this sort of thing were done at night. Come morning, they'd have the breakfast, and they were allowed to sleep then until midday. But with the assault pioneers, we had jobs to do during the day, so we never got sleep in the day. You'd get something unexploded up at C Company, go up there and attend to that, or somebody digging a bunker somewhere and a bit rock, go and blow it out for them. There were always jobs during the day, so we were working sort of day and night, and that's how it went on. We used to spend about a month of time, I think it was about a month of time in the line. That had to be done, I suppose.
Any specific incidents you can remember that happened to you?
Oh, yeah. There was quite a lot, really. A lot. I suppose, really. So my best mate, I made it up with, well, there were four of us actually, made it up in Berlin and went out together. And he got blown up on the minefield. And killed, of course.
How did that happen?
Well, I'd been out on patrol every night that week, and I believe it got to a Thursday, and I was down to go out again that night, and I was protesting about this in a strong term, and this mate of mine, Ron Ecop, he hadn't been out. And he said, "Well, I'll take your place." And he actually volunteered to take my place. And off they went out. Officer, four or five men out of our platoon, and they got on the wrong side of the wire. And Ron Ecott stepped on the mine. That was the end of him. I think three men were blown in the minefield. And Jim Murray, the corporal, came back to the position and got a stretcher, come rescue party out, and they went back out and picked the men up, got the men out of the minefield, and what was left of Ron Ecott. And he saved my life, in actual fact. And so he's a chap I've remembered all my life, and that's one reason even now, every year I go down to London to the parade in Whitehall, because that's all I can do. I've never forgotten him, but as far as anybody else is concerned, he's gone and forgotten. But I've never forgotten him.
Obviously, you weren't there at the time when he was.
No, he'd take my place, and as I say, he saved my life. We even, on our first position, we'd four men wounded. They got into an ambush, and three or four of them got wounded. One lad lost his eye.